Okay, so tonight is the final lesson of our ethics, Talmudic ethics course. And tonight we're going to discuss the concept of copyright in Talmudic law. I actually don't like the word copyright. I think that sounds too... No, copyright kind of gives you, you know, it's an analytical, technical, even a legal word. I think what we're going to be discussing tonight is about intellectual property, and the issue ultimately is intellectual property it differs greatly from any other kind of property because it's not tangible. It's not something you can put in your pocket and say it's mine. It's not something you can put in a bank and say it's mine. It's not something, and often, even in American civil law today, it is one of the most difficult areas of law, right? The concept of intellectual property, of patent and things like that, because ultimately there's nothing tangible. I can't say this is mine and that's yours, because where do I end and where does someone else begin when we're talking about something that's intangible? So that's what we're going to be discussing today. Let's start with reading the introduction as we always do on page 137. Ruby, if you'll be so kind.
In 1774, William Penfield made the following argument in support of the idea of copyright. In this various world, different men are born to different fortunes. One inherits a portion of land. He cultivates it with care. It produces him corn and fruits and wool. Another possesses a fruitful mind, teeming with ideas of every kind. He bestows his labor in cultivating that. The product is reason, sentiment, philosophy. It seems but equitable that a fair exchange should be made of these goods, and that one man should live by the labor of his brain, as well as another by the sweat of his brow. Observation of literary property. Intuitively, it seems correct that people should be able to reap the profit of their own ideas. Is there a basis in the Talmud for this idea as well? That is the subject of this lesson.
Not if you ask Karl Marx.
Not if you ask Karl Marx or Engel, all our good Jewish friends. So, legal systems, different legal systems in recent history have had to grapple with this concept. Again, it's recent history, because the whole concept of intellectual property, as we will see soon, only came about in the past few hundred years, in the way that we know it. In other words, real copyright. Intellectual property may have been around way before then, but the concept of a copyright is rather new. What determines our legal understanding of copyright law is based on our very own Constitution. The Constitution actually talks about copyright law. Let's read that in text 1, page 138.
To promote the progress of science and the useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries.
So the argument being put forth by the Constitution is in order to motivate people, right, to want to innovate, in order to motivate scientists, doctors, and all the different types of people that we rely on to become innovative and want to come up with new ideas, you have to protect their intellectual property. But on the other hand, you can't let that get out of hand. Right? You can't let them have uncontrolled access to whatever they to their copyright, or whatever they patented for an unlimited amount of time. So the Constitution generally ensures that anybody that comes up with a new idea that has never yet been put forth generally is protected for anywhere between 50 to 100 years. That's after the person's death. That's approximately how long that idea belongs to that individual person. Now, the purpose for this, obviously, is for all of us, to the public benefit. If we would not institute these kinds of laws, the public, ultimately, it would be us that would lose, because people would just not feel it, or maybe they would feel, but they wouldn't spend as much time necessary in order to come up with some of the incredible innovations that we've witnessed over the past few hundred years. It takes a lot of time, effort, mind power, and ultimately, human beings are, you know, we're selfish creatures, to, no matter how much we try to be otherwise, and a person works if they will be of benefit. That's just the way we are wired. There will be no benefit for the person themselves. Ultimately, everybody loses out because they won't work towards it. So, it's understood by the American legal system that it's within the right of government, right, to establish laws that further social purposes, innovation, whether it's tangible or intangible, right, that's irrelevant. The main idea here is that we have to put into place something that will benefit the public. And if it benefits the public, the one that came forth with that gets some kind of protection from the United States Constitution. And now let's talk about the Talmudic approach. Over the course of this lesson, we're going to try to figure out what does the Talmud say about intellectual rights. The main question we're going to try to analyze here, and that Constitution does not really address this, and that is the reason why a person is being protected. With his intellectual innovation, is it because of social norms? In other words, some kind of moral understanding between people that if somebody spends time thinking about something and coming up with a great idea, it should only be morally right for us to protect that idea in order for the person himself to benefit? Or is the reason why the Constitution protects this idea because stealing the idea is theft? Which one is it? Is it some kind of moral understanding that we shouldn't steal someone else's ideas, or is it literally theft? Theft of something that's intangible. That's part of what we're going to try to figure out. This is very different than, say, you owning a bottle of water and me stealing it from you. That is theft.
Yeah.
Right? Now, you have an idea, it's in your head, it's something that's intangible.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The reason why we're protecting that idea is because if I take it, it's equivalent to stealing something, or because if I take it, it's morally wrong. In other words, is it theft, or is it just part of what a moral society will implement in order to protect people from having their ideas stolen?
The reason I'm thinking the difference is that they're not mutually exclusive. It's morally, you could say, it is morally wrong because it's theft.
Yeah.
So it's both.
Well, the question is it theft or not?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question. We'll pray for you. So let's look at part B, the origins of copyright law.
Okay.
The origins, we'll read in a second the case there. The origins of copyright law ultimately began in the 17th century. And it was due to the invention of the printing press. Okay, before the invention of the printing press, it was so tedious to copy books, right? That the whole concept of a copyright, because they were written by hand, was really a moot issue. If somebody wanted to spend a month rewriting my book, ultimately the only one that will really benefit from it is me, because the concept of copying was so tedious. With the advent of the printing press, suddenly it became very easy to reproduce thousands upon thousands of copies of any book. And the question then became, who reaps the benefit of that? So the need to establish some kind of system that protects the author of a book or a piece of art that may be very easily and rapidly reproduced in mass numbers became necessary in the 17th century. So let's look at case study C on page 139.
Mr. Abraham Bolger, the publisher of the paper book from above, is suing Mr. Hirsch Balaban, who wishes to print a set of Shulchan Aruch Code of Jewish Law by
here, there's a question being posed to this rabbi about a copyright law. Now, it's important for us to remember, you know, before we, I almost forgot my movie. Let's watch it now. We got to always start with the movie.
According to the Guinness Book of World Records, Happy Birthday to You is the most popular song in the English language. The melody is based on the song Good Morning to All, composed by two kindergarten teachers in 1893. The combination of words and lyrics appeared in print beginning in 1912 with no mention of rights. In 1935, the Sony Company registered for copyright. In 1990, Warner bought the company owning the copyright. The copyright will not expire until 2030. Until then, unauthorized public performances of Happy Birthday to You are technically illegal unless royalties are paid to Warner. What kind of things can be owned? We can own objects that we have made or that we have purchased, or abandoned items that we have found to which we have staked an uncontested claim. But can we own an arrangement of words or an idea? In 1774, William Enfield put forth the following argument in support of the idea of copyright. In this various world, different men are born to different fortunes. One inherits a piece of land. He cultivates it with care. It produces him corn and fruits and wool. Another possesses a fruitful mind, teeming with ideas of every kind. He bestows his labor in cultivating that. The produce is reason, sentiment, philosophy. It seems but equitable that a fair exchange should be made of these goods, and that one man should live by the labor of his brain, as well as another by the sweat of his brow. If people could earn more by copying other people's ideas than by coming up with their own, there would be little incentive to create. Thus, the United States Constitution argues, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. We understand that it is unfair to take advantage of someone else's idea, and that it is beneficial to society to protect artists, inventors, and other creative thinkers so that they are willing to continue coming up with new ideas. But what happens when overzealous claims actually make it harder for creativity to flourish? Can ideas really be owned in the way we own objects or cattle or land? Can we lock an idea away or prevent others from coming up with the very same idea independently? In a computer age, when it is simple to share files of information, the question of copyright assumes new relevance. In this lesson, we examine Jewish perspectives on copyright that can help us navigate the complexity of idea sharing in the modern age. Every day of our lives, we are faced with difficult ethical dilemmas. We grapple with a wide range of problems, the subtle and the complex, the personal and the communal, the mundane and the spiritual. The Talmud provides guidance to help us navigate these choices. Talmudic Ethics, finding your way to good decisions.
Please let me know if it gets too cold, really. I see it blowing down on you. You're not too cold?
No.
It is, yeah? So we can, what we can do is we could, is that good? If it gets too cold, the remote is right here. You can just, okay. We're letting Mushka just finished school today. We got her report card today. And straight A's. For this quarter and the whole year, she only got two B's and no B pluses. So we're gonna let her sit in the class.
What do you call that, monitoring style?
Yeah, but this past session, this semester, way to go, Moshe. So, just very quickly, we've been discussing. We started out speaking about the origins of copyright law. We spoke about the concept of the Constitution protecting copyright law, and that that copyright law really became necessary in the 17th century with the advent of the printing press. So here in case study C on page 139, we basically somebody who owns somebody who's a publisher of Hebrew books is wants to reprint a book that someone else claims he bought the rights to. So the question here is, what do we do? So first of all, before we even start anything, it's important to realize that Jewish law complements the law of the land. There's a concept in the Talmud called Dina de Malchusa Dina, which means that a person must follow the laws of the country in which he lives in. Of course, the exception is if those laws run contrary to the moral and ethical laws of the Torah. In other words, if a country decides that it's okay to steal, then it's not allowed to follow that country's laws. If a country decides that it's okay to kill a certain segment of that population, obviously you're not allowed to follow it. We're talking about when a country has moral ethical laws, such as our country, then obviously you're allowed to follow them, and the Torah tells us that you have a responsibility to follow those laws. That is in text 2, page 140. Michael, your turn.
Shmuel says the law of the land must be obeyed by the Torah law.
So even in the absence of a formal government law regarding copyright, okay, if the custom of the land is to respect and observe a certain level of copyright, we would be required to follow it, as is illustrated in this following text, 3, page 140. More.
The donkey drivers are entitled to stipulate that one who loses his donkey should be provided with another donkey. If, however, this was caused by negligence, they would not have to provide him with another donkey. Where this was done without any negligence on his part, he is provided with another donkey.
So here we're talking about a caravan of donkey drivers. In essence, this is really the Talmud talking about the concept of a union. Right? They have a union of caravan drivers. And they have, in essence, created for themselves an insurance policy. We're all in it together. Something happens to any one of us, right? The donkey is what's going to get us through the desert. Then we will all chip in and help you, again, unless there's negligence. If you didn't feed your donkey and it died, it's not our fault. So, as we see here, it's understood that there's no law regulating that donkey drivers have to take care of each other, but because they decided to get together and they decided to support each other, it becomes the responsibility and the obligation of every single member of this caravan to pitch in if indeed somebody loses his donkey. So, taking this one level further, there is a 13th century halachic codifier by the name of the Rajbah, Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet, who lived from 1235 to 1310, and he says, he takes this one level further, and he says that in some situations there are even unspoken expectations based on common practice. Let's read in text 4, page 140. Your turn.
If merchants consistently conduct themselves according to a custom, even if they do not formally agree to the custom, nor did they verbally stipulate it, we may presume that anyone engaging in trade is doing so on account of this custom, and the custom is, therefore, binding on all merchants. As if it were expressly stipulated that the merchants are regulated by the base or the court.
So as you see, even an unaccepted business practice or sorry, an accepted business custom amongst a certain trade or a certain group of people, that it's just accepted that this is the way they treat each other, can automatically be enforced by Talmudic law. In other words, the Rashba takes it one level further. He says not only do the people of this trade union have to follow and pitch in and keep to the understanding, but it's even enforceable according to Talmudic law. So now let's go to section 3 in the origins of copyright in the Talmud. There's a concept called hasagat gvul, or unfair encroachment. Now, this concept, let's back up for a second, let's look on the board. We discussed the concept of copyright according to the Constitution, which is basically that for 50 to 100 years, okay, it protects you from infringement. Now the Talmud obviously tells us that we have to support the law of the land. So in the event that a Jewish person or somebody that comes to a Talmudic or rabbinical law has a copyright issue, the law of the land would be what the rabbinical law would uphold, which is that 50 to 100 years there is a copyright. But say that there is no copyright law, saying a country in Holland, let's for example say there is no concept of copyright law, and they come to a rabbinical court, and the rabbinical court would then enforce a similar law of its own system of copyright law. In essence, that would be a law that would not have a expiration date. It would be forever, because there is no law in the Talmud that stipulates that it ends at any given time. If you own, and if intellectual property is yours, it's yours forever. If it's not yours, then there's nothing you can do about it. So if we decide that intellectual property from a Talmudic standpoint is yours, then there is no limitation on that. So with that in mind, let's look at the concept of unfair encroachment according to Jewish law. According to Jewish law, actually let's read text 5. This gives us the concept on page 141. This is from the Talmud, and this gives us an understanding of the Talmudic understanding of unfair encroachment.
A person may open a rival store next to the store of his fellow, and the established operator cannot prevent him from doing so, because the rival can say to the established operator, "You do as you wish inside your property, and I do as I wish in my property." Rav Huna, son of Rav Yeshua, said, "It is obvious to me that a resident of one town applying a certain trade can prevent a resident of another town from applying that trade anywhere in his town."
So here the Talmud clearly is trying to create a concept of trade protection. Right? If I set up shop and I put 20 years into building a reputable business, right, and somebody from another town just comes in and decides to set up the same shop next door, there has to be some system of protection. Interestingly enough, there has to be a balance, because the Talmud says only if it's somebody coming from a different town. The understanding is that in the same town, okay, everybody needs to make a living, and anybody can do what they want to in their city in which they live in. If somebody comes from the outside, we can tell them, look, you got your own town, go set up shop where you are, and do it next to, you want to open a meat shop, go ahead, do it next to the existing meat shop, but not in our town.
For a lot of products, for a lot of things, the whole world is a town. I mean, we're a town now.
Right.
And there's got to be a concept of, well, we have a concept in American law, you know, again, not the antitrust law and this sort of thing. But that would be the reverse side of this coin. Do you know what I'm saying?
The next thing I'm about to say is that ultimately Jewish law says that the consumer's rights supersede everything. In other words, the consumer the population is a lot more of us than the few store owners. So ultimately, if a person comes in and he is selling, say, better wares and for cheaper, then we cannot force him to close down, because ultimately that benefits the rest of us. As you know, this is a very common concept in today's day and age. The Walmart scenario, we read about it in the paper every other day, is a community that's trying to keep Walmart out, because they come in and they close everybody else down, right? There was just this big lawsuit last year in somewhere in South Central, right? Or somewhere around Inglewood, yeah. And the city managed to block Walmart from coming in. According to Jewish law, that would not be okay, because ultimately, when a Walmart comes in, we benefit. It's the consumer that benefits. So here the Torah is trying to, on one hand, protect commerce and encourage people to open stores without threat of being shut down. But on the other hand, the Jewish law Talmudic law is also saying, look, there's a consumer, and the consumer's rights also have to be protected. And ultimately, if this store is going to benefit the consumer, then we have to allow it to proceed. We have to allow it to open. So in essence, what he's saying here, we're trying to compare, right, this concept of protection, commerce protection, to copyrights and patents as well. Because when someone invents a new product, in essence, we should not allow someone to open shop right next to him, right, trying to compare it, and take that product and then sell it, duplicate it, and sell it for his own profit without somehow benefiting the first person. But the problem with this is that ultimately we have to decide. Was somebody trying to? One second. Where are we up to here? There you go, Walmart.
You brought up about the consumer. What if you had a shop, the only shop of that type in a town, and the shopkeeper had been charging him, you know, what he could get because he was the only one there, and now somebody has competition?
Well, competition, again, if it's going to benefit the consumer, in other words, this person is charging exorbitant prices because he could, and someone else comes in and is going to obviously provide a better product for cheaper, then so be it. You have to allow him to do it.
Walmart's not a perfect analogy. I'm not saying that I think this, I don't. But a lot of people ask, well, if the opponents of Walmart say that it ultimately hurts our society because we're sending dollars to China, there's all these other arguments that come into it that it ultimately hurts our
You may be right. I mean, ultimately, we have to look at the big picture. I mean, we just touched upon it, but I think the concept is well understood, that we're trying to find a balance that protects both a merchant and a consumer. But ultimately, there's a lot more consumers than merchants. So their rights usually trump, because there's a lot more of us.
Does the Talmudic law get into the objective area? Say if the second store is coming in from another town, they're well funded and their idea is just to drive the first guy out, and maybe their products aren't as good. Who makes that determination? That's the promoter of the product.
I think ultimately
it would be
a rabbinical court that decides. And I mean, we can never really know the true intentions, because sometimes what happens is they drive everybody under and then they start raising their prices gradually. So if you think they're going to do that,
they could have done it in two other towns.
Right. And you see that sometimes, you know, the big retailers come in, they drive everybody out.
In the olden days, I mean, you had the towns separate. With the court is the subjective argument.
But they have to, sure. Their responsibility to make a to make a to make a educated decision. The only way they can make an educated decision is by hearing all the arguments. So now what we're doing is we're comparing, right, two areas of commerce, so to say. One is clearly a tangible area of commerce, right? Two stores, somebody sets up shop next to each other, next to another, there's clearly a tangible conflict. However, the concept of intellectual competition is not tangible. So the question is, can we compare these two things? So now what we're going to talk about, let's go to section B. So we're going to talk about the concept of copyright as ownership of an idea. In other words, the question now is there a case in the Talmud? Again, as I mentioned in the beginning of tonight's lesson, because the printing press was not around in the days of the Talmud, a rabbinical court, say the one that is dealing with our opening case in the 17th century, beginning of the 18th century, is trying to look at precedent. We'll look at the Talmud and say, is there any kind of precedent of intellectual property? And if there is a precedent of intellectual property, how does the Talmud look at it? Does the Talmud look at it as real ownership? In other words, can we compare two stores competing to two people competing in regards to ideas? Or is it entirely different? So that's what we're going to be trying to do over the next few minutes. We're going to try to look at precedent and see how the Talmud looks at intellectual property. So let's look at text 6, page 142.
Don't steal from a poor man, for he is poor. Rabbi Shimon said, someone who does not credit the source of the original statement and repeating it to others is a violation of the verse, don't steal from a poor man.
So as you can see here, the Midrash clearly says that when someone represents someone else's idea without crediting the original owner, it's theft. And this is clearly talking about ideas, right? There's nothing tangible. So here, this little reading just took this concept one step further. We're saying not only is there real ownership, but there's even theft in regards to just taking someone's idea and not crediting them with that idea. Yeah, Erwin.
That would be plagiarism, and it could happen. How about a different premise? My premise is this: the copyright is poppycock, and that, or it should be very, very limited. If I'm a carpenter, I build a unique, original piece of furniture, and I sell it. It's original. Am I entitled to collect some sort of royalty every time it's resold? No. It was an idea, and I've seen over and over.
If I can patent it, though, we see patents all the time.
But not if I just build just a piece of furniture itself. Is there something you can say? Something
there has to be something that? Unique, right? There has to be something unique.
But even if it's unique, once it's removed, sometimes by generations from the person that created it, why retain royalties to relatives of the creators who died 30, 40 years ago? Why is Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck still protected? They should be in the public domain by now.
Well, what we did
these
was
these aren't poor people, and
right.
The rabbis see here. These are rich corporations that are doing nothing creative or new on those characters and benefiting billions of dollars.
Yeah, but if you have property, you should be able to bequeath it.
Yeah, like why
is
these
so
persons getting money from
Elvis
and Rusty Miles and Records? Agreed.
Right.
He came up with the original property. It's not tangible, but it's still he left that just like you would leave an estate, you know, and I think increase in what in value over years. The same thing with intellectual property, whether it be music or ideas.
Well,
right.
What you're saying, I mean, let's back up for a second, because this is what we started this tonight's lesson with. Right, we started out with the Constitution. And the understanding of the Constitution is that the reason why we protect the whole copyright laws in the Constitution is because we want to encourage innovation. Innovation benefits everybody. it benefits the entire population. So I think everybody in this room will at least admit that some level of protection, right, is called for. The question is, what level? So, Irwin, what you're saying is that 50 years is too long. Okay, that's arguable. Okay, I mean, the Constitution ultimately protects patent laws anywhere from 50 to 100 years. So that may be too long. Okay, but everybody agrees that some level of protection is necessary for us. Because if we don't provide that protection, people just won't innovate. And people don't innovate, we don't have light bulbs. Right? We don't have electricity.
They all innovate no matter what. And they do every day all the time. And we hear right now this endless campaign on the radio, snitch on your employer. Tell them, turn them in, make $1 million if you knocked off a copy of some software. What kind of message is that? Why do we... There's so much creativity going on, whether it's
protected or not. But what you brought up is a good example as well. Okay, here you have a company called Microsoft, who spends billions of dollars a year in research. In research, they have tens of thousands of programmers that they're paying $250,000 per person. Just put those numbers together. So they need to and to copy a CD is talk about the printing press. Forget the printing press. CDs. They take 10 seconds to reproduce Microsoft Windows that cost Microsoft $20 billion to create. Right? 10 seconds. I have a copy. So there has to be some kind of system of protection. Otherwise, Microsoft will simply, or the potential Microsofts, right, will not only just go out of business, they simply, there won't be a business model for others to follow. However, if there is some kind of protection under the law, now notice they're not going after individuals, they're going after corporations. The reason
we have to have a rule, right? Are we arguing American law or Talmudic law?
Well, we're talking about Talmudic law, but we started is that Talmudic law supports the law of the land and things like that.
Well,
but
in China, they don't recognize anyone.
Well, okay, so then.
I have to say here, those skills for my school, sufficient to say do not steal.
From a poor man.
Right, and okay.
It was okay to steal from a rich man.
Yeah, that's
I guess we can take from Bill Gates, huh? He's got enough.
Erwin, what you were talking about, big corporation, General Motors, just lost out. They haven't been making the automobile car for a little while now. They forgot to renew the patent thing, and somebody else snagged it up. On what? On what thing? What was the automobile car?
Oh yeah.
Not that this person who got there right is going to make them, but General Motors just kind of messed up.
Yeah, sure.
Take care of business.
But what
happened?
Okay, so let's get back to the text. So that obviously the text does give us an idea of intellectual property and not crediting the origin of any given statement. However, the problem with this is that there are many codifiers that look at this specific text and claim it is really metaphorical. It's not to be used in a halakhic standpoint. So now we're back to square one. Is there any compelling legal precedent in the Talmud that would give us an understanding of intangible ownership and protection for that intangible product, whatever it may be? So we're back to square one. Page 143. Again, we're on a hunt, we're on a fishing expedition. through the Talmud to try to find some kind of precedent, because remember, the Talmud was around 2,000 years before copyrights were ever existed. So that's what we're trying to do. This is what we do in the yeshiva.
Yeah.
We try to find precedent, which is actually similar to what you do in any legal environment. Okay, if you're going to argue in front of a federal bench, or definitely in front of the Supreme Court, you always want precedent. From that court, obviously, is the most powerful precedent you can find. And that is the exercise we're going through. So let's look at text 7 on page 143.
Yep. Oh, is it me again?
Yeah.
Oh. That's the kicking track. Fishing nets must be kept away from a fish which has been targeted by another fisherman the full length of the fish's swim.
So a fish's swim is 2.5 miles. That's what it ends up in. About 2.5 miles.
Oh, okay.
So what's interesting here is that the commentators point out, okay, that we're protecting targeted fish that have not yet been caught. Remember, they're not in the guy's nets yet. And this is called, it's a Hebrew term called hefker. In other words, the fish in the sea belong to anybody. So we're saying that within a 2.5 mile radius of somebody who took the time to set up their nets, somebody else cannot encroach, because anything in that area will be considered that fisherman's.
So that means targeted, that the nets have been set out.
Yeah, but not yet been caught.
Not just that they're thinking about fish.
Right. So that fish, if it swims out of a 2.5 mile radius, obviously can be caught in another net and is equally someone else's.
And they root for
well,
fish.
Kind of.
Either way,
to the ocean.
Either way, that fish is ending up on our plate, huh? But, so the question now is, so let's analyze this. It's a good question you're asking. In other words, if I understand you correctly, what you're asking is that if I know somebody else is working towards a discovery but has not yet reached it, can I be working towards the same discovery? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, and copy the same research.
It's not, that's very different. That's a very different scenario. Because, well, okay, so now this is going back to the concept that we mentioned before, which is hasagat gvul, which means the gvul literally means a boundary. In other words, encroaching on someone else's business. This is what we're trying to say. So here what the Talmud is saying, look, this is a fisherman. He spends many, many hours building his nets and putting out a net. So we're going to give you a 2.5 mile radius. Anything within that 2.5 mile radius is considered encroachment, even though the fish that are in this 2.5 mile radius don't even belong to him. They're a potential catch, but not an actual catch. But that's very different than saying, because I want to put out a net in that 2.5 mile radius, you cannot go there for a week in advance. If somebody is working towards a specific innovation, everybody in the world should be trying to get there as well. Once I get there, suddenly everybody else has to back off, because I was the one that got there first. And there's a concept of, you know, the Talmud talks about, you know, first ownership. I'm the owner. Fine thing to fly. Exactly.
Is this a network issue?
This is a network issue, exactly, with the net.
I just got that.
But in essence, so the question now is, can we compare this specific Talmudic case to our concept of intangible ownership? Because here, clearly, the fisherman is claiming some kind of ownership over something that's not his yet.
Yeah, but he's taking an area. like dividing up the ocean and saying this much area belongs to you and this much area belongs to you, so it's
right.
And then whatever fish happen to swim in there, they get it. I don't think it's the same thing as...
It's not the same. So let's go around the table. What do you think? Can we use this as case precedent?
No.
That fishing in the net doesn't really go much more than maybe a couple hundred yards, does it?
Bad picture.
What? No, I mean it would go by a couple hundred yards.
Oh, you mean the net itself, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably. So in other words, we're saying irrelevant of the size of the net.
It's just arbitrary.
We give a person a fish
a
swim.
Half.
Yeah.
It's just arbitrarily give
2.5 miles, yeah.
In those days, did the Talmud know the Bible?
They use the term parsa. In other words, a fish swim, the Talmud says, is a parsa. Parsa is a Persian measurement that we know today is approximately 2.5 miles.
How would you explain all the Starbucks next to net cost me a few weeks like cost each other. 2.5 miles
there. Each one claims to be giving a better product. Right? That's their claim.
Okay.
That we're better. So if you're better, and again, I think this goes back, don't forget, this is today's conglomerates are very different than what we were discussing before. Somebody in a town, everybody has to make a living, right? And somebody needs, you know, everybody had, and society was built in a way that we have to protect the people in the town. Again, I wasn't using that as a not an actual correlation, but just we're trying to find concepts, right? The concept was to protect a person's business. To say that if the same exact scenario would apply, in other words, if I want to open a shop and somebody from Burbank wants to open a shop, can he bring me to rabbinical court? You know, it's very different today.
Or the city council. I mean,
right.
I mean, like you said, like Walmart.
Right.
But most of the time, it doesn't happen. So, where would this, you know, apply today? I mean, like, you know, it doesn't.
No, the concept does apply of protection, right? Commerce protection does apply.
If I open another coffee shop next to Starbucks with a very similar logo, with a very similar color,
they'll take you to court. And also there's antitrust laws, don't forget. If a conglomerate gets too big, it starts undercutting, like Microsoft is being sued all over the world for antitrust. Not in America, but in Europe, there's a huge case against them, and they lost. Because basically, a basic understanding of a society is the concept of competition. If you remove competition, right, society as a whole will lose. So a forward-thinking society will have to keep some element of competition alive, always. And that's what we're discussing. Now, you know, the exact shtetl scenario obviously may not work anymore today. So the question now open to everybody is this an accurate correlation? In other words, can we use this as a case precedent can we compare this to intellectual ownership?
Well,
or is it a far stretch?
Because what they're protecting is an area, really.
That still comes down to tangible property.
And that's something different.
So ultimately, commentators point out that this is a clear protection for business, for a business. In other words, the reason why the Talmud is giving a person such a wide swath of unowned water, right? Let's use that description for lack of any other better description. It's simply because we want to encourage business. Okay, it's a protection for a business and for competition. So we cannot ultimately use this text alone to strengthen our understanding of intellectual ownership and protection thereof. So our search continues. Let's try to find some kind of text, something we can rely on to back our supposed understanding of the Talmudic protection of copyright law. So the following case we're about to read, in essence, is groundbreaking in terms of copyright in Jewish law. This text was, again, written in the early in the mid-1700s, and it was from the responsa of Rabbi Yecheskel Landau. So let's read text 8 on page 143.
I was asked by someone from Livorno the following question. Reuben authored a commentary on the Talmud and wished to have it published together with the text of the Talmud. He negotiated a fee from Simon, a publisher, to have the text of the Talmud printed along with the classic commentary of Rashi and Tosafot on each side and the author's commentary on the bottom of each page. Ordinarily, after printing a book is completed, printers dismantle the arrangement of the letters on the plate so that the letters will be available for other printing endeavors. However, in this case, Simon, the publisher, who owned many sets of letters for other printing projects, decided to leave the arrangement of the letters designed for Reuben's publication on the plate. Simon intended to take advantage of the long hours and hard work that was invested in creating these plates in order to be able to publish in the future a regular edition of the Talmud with the classic commentaries without Reuben's commentary. Reuben claims that since he paid for the work arranging the letters of the Talmudic text, Simon has no right to benefit from this arrangement in the future without granting Simon a share of the profits of the second printing of the Talmud. On the other hand, Simon argues that since the actual physical letters belong to him, he has the right to use them as he pleases. Reuben has no right to demand that he destroy the arrangement on the plate.
Here we're going right to the beginning of the press, right? This is in the mid-1700s, and here we have going right to the beginning of the printing press, right? Here you have one of the first examples of the halachic law, right, Jewish law, tackling this concept of a copyright. So what do? So Rabbi Landau ultimately makes clear that if according to agreement, okay, Reuben did not charge separately for each service involved in the process. In other words, if he paid one lump fee to Simon, okay, it wasn't itemized, then Simon could ostensibly say, I may have kept my price low because I intended to reuse the plates at a later date and reprint my own version of the Talmud without your commentary. However, if it was an itemized bill, in other words, Reuben charged separately for this and for this and for this, then obviously the rights now belong to a certain extent to Simon, because he itemized the bill and paid for the arrangements of the plates. So I want to mention that in case anybody has ever seen it was a very tedious process. Making plates of the entire Talmud probably took years, literally, because they had to put, you know, they had to make entire pages line by line in every single, you know, it was a really tedious process.
It seems to me that it was no agreement up front, then the person set up the plates owns
it. Exactly. So there's no itemized agreement.
So there's no agreement at all.
Well, they would not have done it without an agreement. There had to be some kind of agreement.
What kind of an agreement did they have?
Well, that's what he's saying. In other words, if it was a detailed, itemized agreement...
It's an implied agreement.
Right.
I don't see the difference whether it's itemized or not, because it's like saying, because I invented the Orange Julius, I now own the patent to the orange. In other words, the Talmud... And Rashi's and Rabban's, their commentary, that's public domain, I guess. In other words, that's something that was the only original part was Reuben's.
What we're talking about here is the actual arrangements of the plates. In other words, a printer, say, spent a half a year with labor, right, arranging the plates. Mm-hmm. So now Reuben says, look, those, I paid for those arrangements, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to reprint the Talmud, go ahead, but you got to give me a cut. So what Rabbi Landau here is saying is that if it was a lump sum,
mm-hmm.
right, then Simon can claim, hey, look, I charged you less for the arrangements of the plates because I planned on reprinting the Talmud. However, if it was itemized and he paid, say, $1,000 for arranging the plates, then Reuben can always say, look, I paid specifically for the arrangement is mine. Now you want to reuse that arrangement, in other words, the intangible labor, go ahead, but give me a cut.
Mm-hmm. So what did they ultimately decide?
Okay, so that's, in other words, it, Rabbi Landau, ultimately part of his decision process was if it was itemized or wasn't. But,
quick question.
Yeah.
It's so much that he's asking the pattern of the orange, but technically, like, as it's a place for, like, the blenders that make the orange Julius. And you had the guy make him a blender to make a special orange Julius, and then he kind of took that and went and started a business and used the blender.
Exactly. Don't forget, the Talmud itself is not patented. It's like the Bible.
So
nobody holds a patent on it.
You just put this commentary on this side and that commentary on that side.
So it's an intangible arrangement,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So that's the question. Can a person charge for something that's intangible? You arranged, right? An arrangement can be owned. I can't give you an arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
The Talmud can be arranged different ways, is that what you're saying?
No, the arrangements are the plates. The actual plate. The way they the printing, I think it's important that we explain the way it
goes back to the time that they used to use the letters and set up letters.
The way,
I understand that, but I thought the Talmud is the way it is.
Yeah, but the original, the first few printings of the Talmud, right, required tedious labor of taking, you know, the plate and arranging.
So how could it belong to any particular?
Well, that's the question.
Oh.
In other words, one person is saying, I paid for the arrangement of the plates,
yeah.
right? You want to reprint the Talmud, I need to get a cut of it. The other one is saying, look, you don't own it. It's an intangible, it's just part of the whole printing process. It's mine. I want to reprint it. I will get it. So the question now is, can we use this as legal precedent from the Talmud to underscore our protection of copyright law? So... I mean, because ultimately it's clear that Reuben, right, clearly does not own the actual plates. The plates belong to the printer, right? All he can claim is to the intangible arrangement of the plate.
The idea of how to arrange
it. Right,
okay.
The idea of arranging it. So, can that arrangement be considered his? And Rabbi Landau says that in the event that it was an itemized bill, he could claim it to be his. In other words, here we see clear ownership over an intangible item. To the extent that he can even claim a percentage of the profits.
But that's also subjective. Even in an itemized bill, if the printer charged him less, knowing he was going to use it in the future, then he got into a further argument.
Right, we'll never know. Ultimately, we have to rely upon the moral scruples of the printer when he says that he charged less because he wanted to reuse it. I guess that can also end up in a rabbinical court. So Rabbi Landau actually uses the next Talmudic text to support his notion that it's possible for Reuben to actually own the arrangement. Let's look at page 144, text 9.
Rav Kizda said to Rami Bar Kama, if one lies in the yard of his fellow without the latter's knowledge, does he have to pay him rent or not? The question is in regard to a yard that is not for rent, but the squatter is the person who usually rents. What is the law? Can the squatter say to the owner, what loss have I caused you? Or perhaps the owner can say to him, Why you have benefited? The squatter would have had to rent different quarters. The Talmud concludes, Ravah, the son of Rav Huna, said, thus did my father, my master, say in the name of Rav, he does not have to pay him rent.
So again, I have to quantify it. When we say that Rav Chizda said to Rav Kama, one lives in the yard of his fellow without the latter's knowledge, does he have to pay rent or not? Well, if you don't know about it, how will you ever know that he should? So what we're talking about is not that he actually didn't know about it. What we're quantifying here is that it's not so much his lack of awareness, but that the owner didn't say something. In other words, there's a squatter on my property and I did not tell him to get off. Now, does the guy have to pay rent or not? So Rabbi Landau derives from this that as long as there is no damage, in other words, there's a concept called Zenena Vezelay Chosin. You done?
No, I'm
sitting
next to you.
Are you going to sit next to me? Okay. Zenena Vezelay Chosin. In other words, if one person benefits, another one does not have any damage as a result of another person's benefit, then I cannot ask the person to pay for that benefit if I do not lose out of it in any way, shape, or form. So, based upon this, going back to our case of the printer, it would seem that the printer can go ahead and reprint it as many times as he wants, because Reuben will obviously not lose anything from the fact that he just reprinted. So this actually seems to go against what we just concluded. We just concluded that Reuben can have ownership over the intangible arrangements. From this, it seems that the opposite is true, that he cannot claim any profit because it's a clear case of me benefiting and him not losing anything. But Rabbi Landau ultimately reconsiders this conclusion based upon the following Talmudic text. The following Talmudic text is ultimately what Rabbi Landau uses as his final deciding factor in regards to charging Reuben, or rather charging Simon for the arrangement if it was itemized. In other words, Reuben can have ownership of that tangible item. Let's look at text 11. Oh, did that skip? Sorry, 10. Sorry.
Come learn, the proof that a squatter is obligated to pay in the following Mishnah. If a ground story and upper story owned by two different people collapse, and the owner of the upper story told the owner of the ground story to rebuild the ground story so that he could be able to rebuild his upper story on top of it, but the owner of the ground story does not want to rebuild, then the owner of the upper story may rebuild the ground story on his own and limit it until the owner of the ground story pays him his expenses. That is, the amount he expended in having the ground story rebuilt. Rabbi Yehuda says, the owner of the upper story who lives on the premises of his fellow without the latter's knowledge must pay him rent. Learn from this that where this one benefits and this one does not lose, the one who benefits is obligated to pay. Talmud rejects this proof. It is different there because of the blackening of the walls.
So the blackening of the walls ultimately means that when a person lives in a brand new apartment, you know, in those days you used to have the big hearth, the big ovens, and when you start cooking, the walls used to turn black. So ultimately what we're saying here is there is a financial loss. So therefore, even if there's a minimal loss compared to the gain, right, of the person building the apartment because you want to live upstairs, still, ultimately, that is enough to lay claim. So going back to our case of Reuben and Simon, ultimately, Rabbi Landau decides that the mere fact that Simon the printer so again, an important point here is even if the loss is minor, right? Yeah, sure. Even if the loss is minor compared, right, to just the blackening of the walls is a minor loss, right? Nevertheless, because there's a minor loss, the owner can claim the entire rent. So let's go back to the case of Reuben and Simon. Simon the printer, by reprinting the Talmud ultimately, may theoretically cause Reuben slight loss. Because some people who don't care about Reuben's commentary may ultimately buy Simon's Talmud, thus Reuben will lose out. He will lose a set of Talmud. Now, obviously, the benefit, right, the profit that Simon will get is far more than any loss that Reuben may encounter, but being that there is that element of small loss, then, in essence, Reuben can go to Simon and claim full compensation for the arrangement of the plates, because there is a minor loss, theoretically. Are we following? So, let's go to text 146. I mean, page 146, text 11. Sorry.
I have a question on this apartment one.
Yeah.
Is the guy in the lower unit, is he in destitute of his place? Has he pretty much given it up? Because from prior classes that we've taken, if he's pretty much just foregone that, then, or is in despair of that particular property, then the guy who's got the upper, wouldn't the Talmud side with him?
Obviously, he still retains some ownership. He hasn't given up his ownership. He still wants I remember the class that you're referring to. That is only if a person clearly gives up and indicates that he no longer retains ownership. But that is not the case here. In other words, he still
he can't afford to rebuild now.
Exactly, he can't afford for whatever reason. Exactly.
It looks to me like putting the horse behind the wagon. When you get into any kind of deal situation, you have to agree on the conditions for the deal.
Well,
if the deal is done, you don't start negotiating.
Well, obviously, I mean, we're talking about situations where it's not clear. If everything is clear, and of course it's always prudent, right, to spell out everything, you know, and to dot your I's and cross your T's, but unfortunately human beings are not like that, and even when they do have clear contracts, often there's differences of opinion. That's why we have courts.
Yeah, but when there is no contract at all, I would tell everybody is losing. No, nobody can have claims.
Right, no contracts are, of course, for
custom and usage.
Well, if there's no contract at all, then we have laws that statute, and then you go by the statute. Someone can die without a will, and there's statutes that determine how the assets are distributed.
Yeah, but speak about trivial stuff like fishing or like building a second story or reaching an agreement on the plate or labor that was done. I mean, there should be it seems to me, a lot of people say, you have to have an agreement before you start. Any kind of relationship, to be not have an agreement, nobody has rights. Nobody has claims.
Well, I'm disagreeing with that. I'm saying they do have rights because we have a law of the land that says in the absence of a contract, these are the rules. That you agree to these rules by default, by being born in this land. And unless you come up to some contract to the contrary, where you make
it doesn't cover every human behavior.
No, well, none of that.
This rule may cover some general behavior.
Well, ultimately, there has to be some kind of rule of law in the absence of any other written agreement. And ultimately, what we're talking about here is when there's a disagreement.
There is a law for every human behavior.
That's true. And thank God, you ask any attorney, they'll tell you that the majority, right, of disagreements don't even end up in court. Because if all disagreements ended up in court, there would be no end. We wouldn't be able to survive a society. I think it's only maybe 10 or 15%. What's the exact amount of disagreements that actually end up being litigated? Everything else ends up being, they come to settled. The same thing in Jewish law. Settlement is the first thing to do. Try to settle outside of court. The only, court is looked at again, we're talking about monetary issues, looked at as a final resort, exactly. So let's now look at text 11 on page 146.
He, the printer, has caused a great loss to the author, for if the printer had not published these second books, there would have been a greater demand for Reuben, the author's work, which included the Talmudic text. Now that Simon, the printer, has printed his volumes, these volumes, which are cheap and in great supply, will reduce the demand for Reuben's work. since the printer has caused the author a financial loss, we obligate him to pay all that he benefited from the author's share in the typeset rental.
So what do you think about, let me open this question out to everybody else, what do you think about Rabbi Landau's juxtaposition of these two cases, of the two houses, right, the upper and lower story, and his case of the printer and the author? Do we think it's a stretch? He's trying to grab for straws here. What do you think about this comparison of the two?
It's a better comparison than the other one.
It's a better comparison than the other one.
Yeah, I don't know if it's perfect, but it's good because you're talking about. Well, actually, yeah. Well, because one is losing, someone's benefiting without someone losing a benefit.
It's the concept that he's going after,
yeah,
right?
It's
the concept he's going after, which is one person benefiting, another person not losing, which is what the Talmud says. However, if one person loses, no matter what the benefit, suddenly there's an issue. Now, the fact that he compares these two, even though one is clearly a house, is a clearly tangible object. It's something that I own. It's something that I can pass on to somebody else. It's something that I can sell. I can buy, so on and so forth. Whereas everybody agrees that in the case of the printer, the author has absolutely zero ownership over the place. They clearly belong to the printer. It's only the intangible concept of the arrangements that Reuben, right, the author, may lay claim to. Yet Rabbi Landau doesn't seem to have a problem with comparing the two. He uses these cases and compares them.
He's not comparing the tangibleness.
But he's using these two cases, right? In essence, he's trying to bolster his case of an intangible item with a similar case, at least he's saying so, of a very tangible item. So what we see from this juxtaposition is that Rabbi Landau obviously says that intellectual, intangible property is of equal value and weight to tangible property. He sees no difference. He compares it.
He's just using the analogy because they're analogous in so much as the concept of benefit and loss.
Right, but don't forget, it's the concept of benefit and loss, but ultimately, if it's apples and oranges, you can't compare them.
Well, he doesn't
because
if it's apples and oranges, he uses apples and apples.
Exactly, and that's the point.
Yeah.
In other words, he's saying we have one case of apples, another case of apples, and the concepts apply equally.
The fact that one's tangible and one's intangible is...
To him means nothing.
Not salient.
Exactly. To him it means nothing. It's the same thing. So that clearly gives us an understanding of the Talmudic view of an intangible item. That is very real. Copyright is a very real concept to the extent that it bears the same weight as a tangible item. So let's look at the resolution of the original case study that we opened our reading with tonight. And that was, if you remember, the case of, let's read it again quickly, on page 139. Mr. Abraham Goldberg, a publisher of Hebrew books in Lvov, is suing Mr. Hirsch Balaban, who wishes to print a set of Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law, Barei Yosef Cairo, with the commentary pre-Toar. Goldberg claims that he bought the rights to this commentary from the author himself. Does Goldberg have any claim against Balaban? And the answer, obviously, from what we've discussed till now, is clearly the person who bought the rights, right, even though it's not tangible, has a very real claim.
Well,
tangible.
He proved that he had bought the rights.
As long as, of course, he proves that he bought the rights. So now, we've just discussed, up until now, the... what we would call a what we would call the nuts and bolts of the Talmudic understanding of intangible property, intellectual rights. And our conclusion was that the Talmud supports this concept and says that intellectual rights are very real. Now let's talk about this. As you know, everything in Talmudic law has spiritual underpinnings. In other words, Judaism, in essence, the laws that we follow are a reflection of some kind of spiritual understanding. So what is the spiritual understanding of property rights? And ultimately, as based upon what we just concluded, in essence, we're saying that intangible intellectual ideas are subject to theft, right? That's our conclusion. Why does the Talmud and why does the Torah go to such extent to try to underscore the ownership of something that in essence is intangible, right? Even the Constitution doesn't do that. The Constitution just says, look, society needs people to think. We are not sure that those thoughts are really a person's or not. We're not sure if really theft applies to it or not. That's irrelevant. The people's needs trump all. We're going to enact laws to protect a person's intellectual property in order to benefit the public. Judaism says the same thing, but takes it one step further. It says, it's theft if you steal someone else's ideas. In other words, it's not just to protect the public. There's a moral problem if you take someone else's intellectual property. You're stealing. It's just like stealing a person's car. And why is that? Why does Judaism look so stringently upon this concept of theft and even intellectual theft?
It's the thing that God gave us that sets us so the one thing that sets us so much apart from all the other animals is our intellect. So it's like that's a very precious gift to the person. You have some ownership of that.
And that's true. And if you look at the Ten Commandments, the extent of to which Judaism places an emphasis, right, on this concept of perceived theft, no, we're not even stealing something. If you look at the Ten Commandments, we have the concept of lo signo, do not steal, and lo sakhlo, do not covet. Right? Coveting is a tangible item. It's an intangible item. Right? When you covet someone else's house, right, it's an intangible thing, yet the Torah says it's wrong. And why is that? Because ultimately this goes back to the understanding, the spiritual understanding of what property ownership is, what ownership is, and what it means to take something that belongs to someone else. And we're going to see this from two readings, starting with text 12 on page 147.
Rav Gito is attempting to purchase a plot of land.
Before you start reading, just the basic concept here is that denying someone else's share in this world, right? Every person's share of this world is considered sacred. By denying someone's share of this world, in essence, you are fiddling with the world order. That's the basic understanding. In other words, there's a divine order. When you try to take someone else's property, you're messing with that order. So let's read text 12. Sorry. Go ahead.
Rav Gidel is attempting to purchase a plot of land. Rav Papa preempted him and purchased the plot. Rav Gidel mentioned this incident to Rabbi Zeira, who in turn related the incident to Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha. Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha told him to wait and that he would discuss the matter with Rav Papa. When the letter would come and visit him, before Yom Tov. When Rav Abba arrived, Rav Yitzchak asked him, when a poor person is attempting to acquire a loaf of bread, and another comes to and takes it away from him, how does one view such a person? He is attempting to acquire an abundant loaf, or to convince his owner to donate it to him. Rav Abba replied, he is called a Rasha, a moral person, since he is in prison said, I did not know that Abdullah was trying to purchase it. Yitzhak asked, perhaps now you sell it to Abdullah. Now Abba replied, I do not wish to sell it, since it is the best time to sell the first piece of property one acquires. However, I prefer to give it as a gift to Abdullah. Abdullah says, I do not want gifts, since the first state, one of his five handouts will live long. But Rav Abba did not wish to own the land either, because Rav Gidl had tried to acquire it. In the end, neither of them claimed ownership of the field. Rather, it was made available for use to all the rabbis, and it came to be called the land of the rabbis.
What a beautiful story.
Can't we just all get along?
Exactly. But the question here is, what's really going on here? I mean, it seems almost, look, I don't want, oh, now I don't want it, but I don't want to take it. You know, it's like, what's going on?
At the beginning, I think it's flawed. I went and I purchased something, and somebody comes and says, oh, I want to purchase it. That's stupid. And then there's a discussion.
Right. But the next reading will actually give us an understanding of what's going on here. In other words, why was each party so adamant not to accept it to the extent that it became public property? The Maharal comments on the mystical significance of this story. Your turn.
The story about Rav Gidl comes to the side of person who uses force to expand his domain improperly as a Rasha. Because God created man and doesn't need the life of it for each and every person, just as two hairs cannot grow out of the same forest, Talmud, Baba, Basra, Ustinay, God gives each person his individual source of nourishment, but he need not encroach upon that which he designated for his friend. If he does interfere with another's livelihood, that is regarded as theft, and worse than theft, since it meddles with the portion that God allotted to each individual.
So, in essence, what the Maharal is writing here is that, you know, there's a kind of divine order, and every person has what is supposed to come to them. And the reasoning behind it is because there is a spiritual connection to even tangible items, right? Judaism tells us that tangible items are not just here by chance, right? The fact that you own a certain car, in essence, there's a spiritual connection between you and the car. Right, it was part of the divine order that you should own this car, or this house, or this piece of clothing. So when you take that element away from the rightful divine owner, in essence, you're depriving a person of some kind of divine physical element, and that is considered to be meddling with the divine order of the world, because everything has a spiritual underpinning. Right, Judaism looks at the world as a spiritual. Everything in the world has spiritual significance, and everything is connected. So in essence, theft is depriving a person of a divine element. And this,
I don't understand the whole thing here. The guy purchased a piece of land. Somebody said, I want to purchase it. Now the person who purchased it
becomes
a
shop. No, you're right. Look, the person who purchased it, we're talking about people with certain sensitivities here. Ultimately, the person who purchased it, right, they would have gone to a rabbinical court, right? A rabbinical court would have said, it's yours, keep it. We're talking about a person who's sensitive and says, look, if I would have known he wanted to buy it, I would have not gotten in the way. If I really, because you know, he's feeling sensitive for the person who wanted to buy the property. Now, could he have held on to it and told everybody, you know, I got it? Sure. And every rabbinical court in the land would have upheld his ownership. We're not talking about ownership here. It's clear that the first guy owns it. We're talking about sensitivity here. And the reason why they were so sensitive goes to the second reading. Because they look at the world as a cosmic experience with divine elements in every single move that you make. So, in essence,
it was rabbis purchasing it, not just the...
Exactly. It was a rabbinical purchase. So there was sensitivity involved. Exactly. So let's look at the last text, which is text 14, and this explains the relationship between a person, his possessions, and his possessions from a divine standpoint. Let's look at text 14, page conclusion of tonight's lesson, in essence what we're saying here is that yes, there is a legal right understanding of protecting a person's property, both physical and intellectual, tangible or intangible, to the extent that Judaism says there, in essence, there is no difference between tangible and intangible ownership. It's equal. And the understanding behind this stems from the spiritual understanding of ownership. And ownership, in essence, applies to intellectual ownership, it applies to physical ownership, and that is a very intimate part of any person's existence. The things that he or she owns, things that he or she thinks about. So when we encroach or try to take away part of another person's identity, in essence, that is considered to be a moral breach of trust of our society in which we live. So let's now do a quick recap. Wow, look at that. Should we do a course review? Or should we do a lesson review? Let's do a... Huh? Yeah, let's go. We'll go through it quickly. In lesson one, we discussed the concept of Judaism is all about rights, is all about responsibilities, whereas we analyzed the Constitution, that it's about rights. And we discussed the concept to the responsibility to preserve rights, to preserve life, ultimately one life or 20 lives or 1,000 lives ultimately hold the same importance because life we can't quantify life. The second course, lesson two, we spoke about end of life issues, and ultimately we discussed how life ultimately holds value, every moment of life holds value, and we are prohibited from cutting that life short. However, we also do not have to unnaturally prolong life. We discussed about pain relievers, so on and so forth. Lesson three was about abortion. We actually spoke about it when we started tonight's lesson. We discussed the concept of all life forms holding value. Although a fetus, for all practical purposes, is not equal to a living human being, nevertheless, it is a form of life, and we are required to protect it under all circumstances, unless, of course, the fetus is threatening the life of a mother. Then we discussed the concept of power of speech and the connection of speech to our very souls, and how it's one of the items that defines a human being and how careful we have to be with our speech. Last week, we discussed the truth, that ultimately Judaism tells us that truth is a very important virtue, however, not at the expense of peace. In other words, peace ultimately comes before truth, and if a person has to lie in order to maintain peace, so be it. Truth is important, but doesn't trump all. And we discussed how in a perfect world, peace and truth would be able to coexist. However, we're not there yet. Hopefully one day we'll get there. And then tonight, we discussed how copyright has only become common in secular courts since the advent of the printing press, made it easy to reproduce written works in large quantities for profit. So any attempt to find support for the notion of copyright in Jewish law must come by way of analogy to some comparable Talmudic law, it should say. Torah requires us to respect the law of the land as well as the assumed ethical standard of a given profession. The prohibition underlying Torah's legal regulation of unfair competition is called Hasagat Gvul, literally moving another's boundary. Talmud applies this concept to encroaching on another's livelihood. 4. One who benefits from the property of another while causing the owner a loss is liable to the owner. Rabbi Landau believes this principle can apply even to the owner of an intangible creation, such as the author who commissioned a particular design of print. Finally, on the spiritual plane, the mystics explain that each person is given his or her designated source of sustenance and need not encroach on another's. Every individual is responsible for the sparks of divine energy within his or her own domain, and thus to preempt another's acquisition of property which is connected to this particular spiritual destiny is a transgression of the true spiritual order. And that concludes our course. And the lesson. I had a lot of fun giving over the course, and I hope you had as much enjoyment, and I hope everybody learned a lot from this lesson, from this course. Yeah.
How much did you learn?
I learned, as I mentioned in the beginning, King David said, "I learned a lot from my teachers, but I learned most from my students."
But
when a person teaches something, you are the one who walks away with the most gains. I have to thank all of you, because I think I learned more than everybody here. Nonetheless, I hope everybody learned something. And thank you very much for joining.